All right. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we are going to be discussing a couple of topics, kind of like we've been doing for a lot of our live streams. We got two topics on deck for tonight. The James White versus Aristotle debate regarding democracy and multiculturalism. And, you know, James White wants to make it about anthropology. So we're going to get into that. And then we also have the Tim Walz, Kamala Harris running mate announcement and the significant impact that that will have on the presidential election, as well as, I think, broader Christian approach to politics. It's kind of unavoidable the impact that this decision has had. I want to use it to draw a contrast between Christian nationalism and the alternative to Christian nationalism, which looks to be Tim Walz to a T. So those are kind of the quick rundown for tonight. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm well.
That's good to hear. Anyway, you wrote the article on James White, so I thought we'd kind of use your article as the backdrop for talking about the issue. But I think before I, you know, let you have at it, I kind of want to weigh in on the debate some, because a lot of people in the apologetics realm, they obsess over the debate between presuppositional apologetics and classical or Thomistic apologetics. And I guess I just got to say, as a complete, just an innocent bystander, onlooker, observer, whatever you want to call me, that this debate to me is very stupid. I just, you know, you're free to disagree with me. When it comes to apologetics and metaphysics, I'm a complete normie, and I'm willing to acknowledge that. I'm much more of a street fighter in terms of, just gathering news, reporting, doing discernment. Just, you know, I don't really care what, you know, which approach, classical apologetics or presuppositional apologetics is ultimately the best to use. I think you can just use either as needed. You know, just keep these tools in your arsenal. I've seen people on both sides, and I'm going to name names for this debate, that have taken this to an extreme, and I think that that has been an unhealthy habit. James White's kind of titular to the live stream. I think he takes this to an extreme, as you see. In my opinion, he took this to an extreme in this, in what we're going to talk about tonight. On the other side of that, the Thomistic side, Cody Leibold, if you remember who that is, and Jacob Brunton, these are two, you know, they used to be very good allies in the discernment ministries and all that other stuff. I don't think that's really the case anymore with anyone who's doing discernment. They are big allies with Michael O'Fallon. I've kind of called them like his dogs in the past, but I do think that they take it to the extreme on the Thomistic side of things. And I think that that has been, unhealthy to watch as well. And I just think, why would you make enemies over something that is,
it's kind of like the
tertiary issue at most.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, wow, if the world wasn't so messed up, we could have the joys of debating classical versus presuppositional apologetics. And keep in mind, I've benefited a lot from apologetic ministries over the years, whether it be like Creation Ministries or like the, which is like the Australian version of Answers in Genesis, or even James White. So this all just comes back to, I don't know why we're picking fights over methods when whatever works. I mean, you know, it's kind of like a playbook. Run the plays that work.
So I want to dive into that, but I do have a special announcement tonight. You might notice the background on the live stream is different. I didn't quite fix it up quite yet, but it is of the book cover for Winning Not Winsome, 10 Commandments of Spiritual Warfare. I've been talking about how I like the cover quite a bit, and I like to think that I'm not wrong for doing so. I really like the cover. It's stylistically, they did a good job, just capturing, you know, some of the energy that I'm going for. So I like the font. I like the look, the aesthetics. I had some say in it, but they ultimately blew my expectations out of the water. Now, if only I can get through with the other issues I have with publishers, but they did a really good job on the title, or not the title, the cover. So anyway, so this is the article that you wrote, if I could just find it, right here. And James White's War Against Aristotle. I did not actually change the headline for this one. I even got a favorable image of James White. You know, it's from Alpha and Omega Ministries, who has blocked me on Twitter, by the way. And you know why?
No, because I don't know when that was.
I want to say it's because I celebrated Michael O'Fallon leaving the board. Because Michael O'Fallon, like, resigned from three boards in one day. One was G3, one was Alpha and Omega Ministries. And I'm trying to remember what the other one... I don't remember what the other one was, but... He resigned from, like, three boards in one day. And I was like, you know, good for you guys to get him off your board. Because, you know, I don't, you know... I think, you know, when you work with an atheist to subvert the church, that's bad. So anyway, it all started with Andrew Torba quoting Aristotle, or at least a book talking about the, you know, Aristotle's view on democracy. And
which, keep in mind, like, one thing that's not really fleshed out in any of this entire debate is that Aristotle is not pro-democracy. So he's talking about a form of government he does not actually endorse. And most Greeks and most people throughout history have not necessarily endorsed democracy. Which, so that just makes it even more ironic that people are reacting to what is said in this text, even though no one involved in the conversation is pro-democracy.
So that, I think that's actually pretty important, because Aristotle was around during the Athenian Republic, right?
That's my understanding.
Athens. So, or sorry, Athenian democracy, I think. I don't know if they were ever really a republic. But I look back on that time period and think about how cringe, like, that time period makes you root for the Spartans, because the Athenians were so cringeworthy with their government. It was just so unstable. You could win a battle, but if you didn't retrieve the bodies or whatever sufficiently enough, regardless of whether a storm, you know, like, we're talking like a naval battle, you didn't retrieve the battle bodies sufficiently enough, they'd execute you or try to execute you or something like that. It was the whims of the people and how cringeworthy it was, you know, whether people would accept peace or not. And ultimately, the Athenians were tyrannical towards the other powers in the Delian League. So the idea that democracy leads to freedom, you know, it's not... It didn't work out for Athens. So I think that's pretty interesting. Aristotle, not a democracy guy. And he's lived in democracy, is my understanding. So I think that's a pretty important setup. You can continue with the breaking down the issue, I guess.
So, I mean, basically the issue is whether multiculturalism can survive in a democracy, or whether a democracy can itself survive with multiculturalism or multiple ethnicities. And obviously this is going to pinch a nerve with a lot of people who have this American conception that, you know, freedom and democracy and, you know, we're all red, white, and blue and one race, human race, because we want to deny the existence of race or the reality of race. And obviously history does not suggest that multicultural democracies can function. And that's what this whole concept of philia or philia is. It's basically, you know, like Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, where the idea of being able to have cohesion because of on shared ethnic grounds or bloodlines is basically critical to the survival or the success of any sort of democracy. And that's what this, I mean, that's what the quote says. A multi-ethnic society is thus necessarily anti-democratic and chaotic, for it lacks philia or philia.
This another word for philia is fraternity. Yeah, the idea of brotherhood.
And then this profound flesh and blood, and this sounds like something in soil, fraternity of citizens. Tyrants and despots divide and rule. They want the city divided in ethnic rivalries, which, again, that describes identity politics to a T, is because you have multiple different races in America that, you know, the Democrats are trying to basically win with everyone with the white people and the married white women. So when you have multi-ethnicity or multiculturalism, every election will basically be, okay, which racial demographics, which ethnicities will back which side? And it's pretty much, like, if we're going to be honest, the number one predictor of anyone's voting record will probably be sex and race. You can't predict someone's voting record based on what a politician's policy.
I want to add on to that, because you look at religion, right? There's only a handful of religions that are indicators of how someone will vote. White evangelical. It's a good indicator that you're going to vote Republican. Jewish. It is a very good indicator that you're going to vote Democrat.
Yeah, literally.
Catholic? No, it's actually not. Mainline Protestant isn't even a good indicator of how someone will vote.
I mean, Jews might be like the third most liberal demographic after like black people and minority women. And then after Jews would be unmarried women, which would include white women.
But like overall, like race is a better indicator of how someone will vote than most religious demographics.
But yeah, number one and number two predictables. So, and then the quote goes on with bolded font, which is this indispensable condition for, ensuring a people's sovereignty accordingly resides in its unity. Ethnic chaos prevents all philia from developing. And again, you know, a lot of people took issue with this, but one thing they did not do was point to a successful example of a multi-ethnic society, unless they want to assume that America is that multi-ethnic society. But, you know, that's where we go on from here in the article.
All right, so I guess that is the debate, because you even see that in a lot better time periods for the United States, there were ethnic divides in, like, cities and stuff like that. But ultimately, I think this is, you know, personal opinion. When we started allowing, you know, not to kind of throw my own people, you know, Italians under the bus, but when you started allowing white Catholics to, you know, come over, that kind of, you know, white Catholicism does seem to be the impetus for white liberalism in the United States, in my opinion.
I mean, the Catholics came from a lot of countries where more, I guess, I don't want to say socialistic programs were coming into fruition, but that was kind of one of the things they developed.
Well, if you look at any map that's like, oh, this is the most popular denomination in this county, is like the blue counties are way, you know, were Catholic, overwhelmingly Catholic. I mean, yeah, there's some Lutheran blue counties, which we'll talk about when we talk about Tim Walz, because that's kind of what that's talking about. But, you know, the Northeast, mostly Catholic. The Southern Baptist Convention, you know, dominates the South. And, you know, where are the most conservative people at? Generally the South, not necessarily the most conservative politicians. But there is something, you know, to what I'm saying is like, you know, Catholicism, not a strong indicator of how someone will vote, and thus is the, you know,
not at this time. It might have been at one point in time. And I think abortion was that issue, which kind of flipped a lot of Catholics. Oh, this actually came from Zachary Garris a while back. He said, reading on the decline of the South of Sabbath practice in America after the Civil War, two major factors were people not knowing the Sabbath during wartime, i.e. the Civil War, or the influx of Catholic immigrants who did not practice the Puritan Sabbath. So, and then he concludes with cultural change decayed or destroyed Sabbatarianism in America, not theology. The theological arguments came later, and that really stuck out to me because his premise is that we didn't change our theology until after the culture changed. So the Catholic immigrants really, you know, brought about, you know, doing things on Sunday. You know, so as Stephen Wolf likes to say, he wants to close every Wendy's down on a Sunday. Like, you know, the Wendy's is open and the lacrosse league is happening on Sunday. And I guess he attributes that to Catholic immigration, which was not Sabbatarian in their theology.
Yeah.
And then how many issues do we change our theology on simply because the culture changed?
I might also have a hot take on Nick Fuentes coming up in this. I got a clip from him on deck, which, you know, speaking of, someone who wants to do America first needs to be Vatican first, but it's like America was designed to be a pan-Protestant nation. Even living in Maryland, which was supposedly the Catholic colony, I believe Catholics represented like 2% of all colonists in the 13 colonies. So Catholics were still like an insignificant,
probably a minority within Maryland.
Yeah. I believe that flipped sometime in the 1600s that Protestants became the majority in Maryland. But anyway,
short-lived Catholic experiment.
Anyway, you can continue since it's your article.
I guess we can move further down.
Because this is where James White responds.
Yeah, so he responds to that tweet as it stands. I mean, I kind of discussed I summarized the idea, and
yeah, multiculturalism and democracies don't mix.
So James White's objection is that Aristotle had no Christian concept of man. He had no Holy Spirit. And then his second objection is that he was speaking to city states, like small city states.
As opposed to large nations.
Yes. And surely you would agree that some Greek word here of which he speaks refers to ancient unity of tribe and family.
Philia is what he's, I believe that's the word. That is. Yeah, I think so.
Which is kind of a flex on using Greek. And that in our modern context, philia would most clearly from a common commitment, not to ethnos. Again, common commitment versus ethnos. You'd actually have to, I guess, provide, I don't want to say evidence, but like what provide an argument on what even the common commitment is in our modern context. Because you're volunteering this argument. What is our common commitment? What, the Constitution? Like what is our common commitment? I didn't even touch that in my article.
But I find that to be an odd objection because, okay, so what that Aristotle's speaking of city states, but it's not like he's unaware of other nations out there, you know, like the Persians don't exist.
Well, even still, like
and he know the Persians are a very multi-ethnic society.
Yeah, but obviously they're not necessarily a democratic one. You can have multi-ethnic
democratic
societies that are authoritarian in structure, and those work out just fine. You can look at Singapore, which would be a good example. It's a clean city. You know, they'll beat you up if you try to vandalize.
Yeah, if you like spit on the sidewalk. You know.
Yeah, they take that stuff very seriously. Very orderly society, though. No crime, higher trust. But it is technically multi-ethnic. So I pretty much object to the notion that I first bring up the fact that the reformers did argue using Aristotle's logic and his findings and his conclusions. But again, the other issue I argue is that there is a scale problem. Like if it doesn't work on a city level, it's not going to work on a transcontinental level. So I don't understand how you can't use Aristotle because he didn't have a Christian conception of man. I think that's very ridiculous.
And then can't use him because he's speaking to a city state. So he's trying to come up with a second reason, a fallback reason for why you can't use him.
And then
it sounds like,
and then I finish off the paragraph. I perhaps did not explain this part properly. But I said throughout history, ethnogenesis has combined various smaller tribes into greater peoples, such as the Italian peninsula following the invasion of Hannibal. So if you want to know where like how the Romans became an empire, it's because they essentially combined their I guess, bloodlines with the other Italian peoples. And that, and you know, after all their warring, they actually did deplete a lot of their middle class. So expanding their, you know, what it means to be Roman actually benefited them in allowing them to form an empire that is, you know, legendary to this day. And again, they're not the only example. The British would be another example of multiple ethnicities coming together to form a greater people. I mean, to some extent, America could have been that, or was that. And even Germany, but we can't really talk about that part. Perhaps Russia would be another example of, and of course, Greece. The various Greek city-states combined to form what would be Alexander's army.
I mean, and they were also all Hellenics.
And, you know, James White should know that Koine Greek was derived out of the multiple dialects that preceded the Hellenization of the world.
But it is worth noting that the Macedonians were viewed as backwater.
Yeah.
And barely Greek. But, again, they are now sufficiently Greek as a result of conquering all of Greece.
And so the idea that, so I do want to finish with the idea that ethnicity is not stagnant. And that's probably the one thing I didn't necessarily explain it throughout in the article as clearly as I could have, because, you know, it's kind of there as an afterthought. But I mean, if it doesn't work, but if philia doesn't exist on a local level, it's not going to exist on a trend. Like, you can't scale it. Like, if you can't have it on a smaller level, you're not going to have it on a large scale. And I don't understand how him talking about city-states invalidates him talking about nations.
Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help, you save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fallback objection. I mean, I don't get the objection, because are we talking about, because James White wants to make this about anthropology. He doesn't have a biblical understanding of, he's not regenerate, therefore he can't understand human nature, which I think is an insufficient argument, in my opinion. I think you can understand as an unregenerate person that human nature is basically evil. I think you can actually understand that people are flawed and that people have an evil nature. I think you could be unregenerate and solve that. Now, most people don't believe that. I think who aren't regenerate, they believe that human nature is basically good.
Yeah, but that's
something else is a cause.
That might be a more modern thought process, though.
Yeah, and I think you might be onto something that, you know, maybe did the ancient Greeks necessarily believe that? No, I'm not super informed on ancient Greece, much more into ancient Rome, which was a culture that did value virtue a lot more than the Greeks did. So, but part of it is like, oh, we can't really trust what Aristotle said on these things because he was unregenerate. That kind of be like, we can't trust, you know, Julius Caesar on military tactics because he was unregenerate.
Yeah, I mean,
but, you know, let's just assume George Washington was a faithful Christian for the sake of argument. Does that mean that George Washington shouldn't have taken military advice from the ancient Romans? Because when he's campaigning against the British, he was using Roman tactics, Fabian strategy, avoiding pitched battle. That was George Washington. And then we're going to attack the garrisons.
Well, I mean, if you read
Trenton and Princeton,
if you read the Federalist Papers, they talk about Rome, Greece all the time. Like, they have a lot of history that they weave into their arguments. And now, again, some of it is post-Christ because they are talking about other Christian nations. Like, I think they talk about Poland.
I believe they talk about the Dutch Republic.
The Dutch. So they do speak to various republics throughout history that they're taking from. But they obviously do pull from the Greeks. So the idea that... So I don't understand how you can argue political philosophy or even the merits of a constitutional republic without addressing, you know, various republics throughout history. Like, you would have to rely on the Greeks to formulate an argument in favor of a constitutional republic. Otherwise, I mean, the Bible is not necessarily going to help you out because it doesn't necessarily promote such a form of government.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't exactly a good example of the Bible and scripture. And because, you know, if the Bible wanted to prescribe democracy in full force, it's not like the concept didn't exist when Paul's writing the New Testament. And Paul was a citizen of Rome, which entitled him to some voting rights. You know, I assume Cilicia was a senatorial province.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, essentially, Eric Cohn and James White go back and forth. And essentially, Cohn objects to the juxtaposition between ethnicity and Christian faith. So White is trying to essentially make the argument that, you know, your shared faith transcends over ethnicity, which, I mean, it's not that isn't true in a sense, but he is trying to insert a conflict where none might exist. Because if you live in a majority Christian nation, then that majority Christian nation will also have shared ethnicity. And so I kind of break out James White's tweet because it's kind of long. And he basically responds to various objections that Cohn makes. That's what's with the stars.
And then the only objection I remember Eric Cohn or Cohn, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. I'm sorry. And I follow him on Twitter. I'll bite. What is the DL? And referring to the dividing line, because James White's like, I'm gonna, you know, do a live stream or whatever on this, on the dividing line, and he's like, I'll bite. What's the DL? And you know, that was a pretty good troll, in my opinion.
I mean, because it. DL is down low,
deadlift. There's a lot of replies in that.
So the first objection or question and answer is, are you assuming Aristotle couldn't make true observation about nature or politics because he wasn't degenerate, and why? And then, as I explained on the DL dividing line, of course, Aristotle was talking about small city states, very different than the context we face today. Further, what I said was he lacked the vitally important reality of divine revelation as to man made in the image of God, sin, redemption, regeneration, etc. As such, he could not accurately speak to how unity among sinners could ever be obtained. Do you think a true analysis of man's condition could be derived from outside special revelation?
Okay, but wasn't Aristotle's quote about how unity can't be maintained in these conditions, like these conditions will destroy the unity of a society? So he's not being utopian. If Aristotle was being utopian, that quote, you know, James White would have a point.
Well, I mean, again, this is where we go back to the reformers, which would actually be his second objection. I basically talk about how politics as we know it is generally viewed through an Aristotelian lens. Like,
as we know it, do you mean people on the dissident right, or do you mean people on the neoconservatives?
Political science as it is taught, as it is known. I mean, we generally use Aristotelian framework, autocracy, aristocracy, and republic. And then they have their negative forms, which would be, it might be monarchy instead of autocracy, but it'd be tyranny, it would be oligarchy, and it would be democracy. Democracy is actually the negative form of republic. So that is the lens of which we categorize governments. And then obviously we have to refer back to the American founding fathers, who, again, the reasons they didn't want a democracy and that they wanted a republic was because they understood Greek philosophy on the subject of democracy. And
a special plug, if you haven't seen the John Harris's documentary, was it 1607, Virginia First?
Yes.
That talks about how Virginia was an Aristotelian republic and then pass that on to the rest of the nation, the other colonies.
Yeah, I mean, when we
look led at, the way in this.
When we look at America at its founding, you should actually consider it an aristocratic republic, not a republic or democracy, but it's aristocracy. Only landowning white men could vote over the age of 21. That's an actual republic. But again, one thing that, you know, all the philosophy teaches about democracy or republics is that they always descend into a democracy. Like we can see this in Rome, where over time they expand the electorate, and we've expanded the electorate farther than any other civilization before us, with, you know, women, other peoples. We've actually lowered the age from 21 to 18. We've made it direct election of senators. So we've expanded the franchise beyond what a republic would do, and we turned a republic into a democracy. And now, I mean, you even have people talking about lowering the voting age to 16 or allowing illegals to vote.
And you got the the idea of getting rid of the Electoral College, or a bunch of states forming a compact, which wouldn't be constitutional unless approved by Congress, to tie their Electoral College votes to the national popular vote. I don't know if you've heard about that movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while because they haven't dredged it up for this election cycle.
But, you know, that's like one of the last vestiges of
of an actual republic.
Right, is the Electoral College. So then we have this part. This is where it talks about Ignatius.
Yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to.
So the question,
if we're ready to talk about the reformers or the early church fathers.
So the question is, if so, this certainly is not how the bulk of the church fathers or reformers treated him. So that's Eric Cohn speaking, in saying that the church fathers and reformers were positive towards Aristotle. And then James White's response is, Eric, where did Ignatius, for example, make reference to Aristotle? Again, that's an argument for absence. Clement of Rome, who is first century. Why did Tertullian say, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? Do you really think the influx of Greek philosophy as seen in Clement of Alexandria or Origen was a positive development? I'm pretty sure Origen like cut off his member because of he took Matthew.
He took Greek he took a lot of Greek ideals pretty seriously.
Yeah. And was a positive development. Are not the scriptures sufficient for the man of God? Where did Calvin, for example, direct us to Aristotle for insights into the human condition and the peace we seek in society? Now, again, probably should not have brought up Calvin, because there's a clear contrast with how the reformers in, you know, the Reformation period, over 1,000 years removed from the church fathers.
I gotta interject. What does he have against Clement here? Because wasn't, you know, Clement's, again, someone who definitely had some views on predestination that, you know,
Clement of Rome or Clement of Alexandria? Those are two different people.
Okay, which one was the...
I assume he's talking Clement of Rome in the first Clement.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, what does he have against Clement?
But you notice he's clearly using more patristic writers early on, which might more support his argument, because, I mean, let's be honest, the first couple hundred years of Christianity do have a lot of messy issues dealing with the Gnostics, the Nicolaitan heresies, and just how Greek culture, I guess, was fusing with Christianity in the early church. And as the early church became more Greek than Jew, then obviously there is going to be growing pains. And that's going to happen regardless of what culture Christianity spreads in. Like, you know, obviously, like Mexico is a bad example where you have synergy between the local pagan religion and Catholicism. And that's, don't they have like the Virgin of Guadalupe?
Yeah.
So that would be a bad example of synergy that happens, but that is, it's expected that there's going to be some growing pains and some bad theology that emerges out of Christianity spreading to a new culture. Like, I think we should actually expect that. And again, I do think the Greek culture does have merits. So this is more my conjecture that I don't actually include in the article, but I think there's a reason God, you know, predestined like the Greco-Roman world to be the birthplace or the hub of Christianity. And that would probably be in part because of how Christianity would be developed within a more Greco-Roman context. And that would suggest that their philosophy was helpful for that, I guess.
As opposed to Eastern culture.
Yes, or even a Persian culture. So again, I not trying to be too dogmatic on this, but I do think the developments of the Greeks made it very conducive to the growth of Christianity.
Yeah, I think that's something to point out. And again, you know, one of the things that we're taught, you know, in church history is that, oh, the Christians were salt and light. When contrasted with the decadence of Rome, people saw them as largely an answer. But that undergirding that was the fact that the Roman society, in theory, valued virtue. And, you know, they had cultural values that we would actually see as good, but they've often misplaced them because they had foreign gods.
Well, keep in mind,
false gods.
If we actually look at, and again, this is why did you even bring up Calvin? Because Calvin does not support like White's argument at all. And Stephen Wolf did a great video today going through Calvin's Institutes and explaining how Calvin uses a lot of, I guess, Aristotelian ideas, or how he handles Greek philosophy within his Institutes. And he actually, you know, Calvin alludes to the fact that there were the natural gifts and then the supernatural gifts. So the idea of man being capable of reason is a natural gift. So this is like a lot of people nowadays might refer to man's ability to, I guess, rationalize and discover right and wrong as common grace, but Calvin would refer to that more as natural gifts. And then supernatural gifts were like, you know, grace and eternal life, all that stuff. But Calvin says that we should appreciate the positive developments of the Greeks.
Yeah, it's interesting because on the flip side of that, you have the aforementioned Jacob Brunton, who at one point was arguing that you can know salvation through general revelation, which I don't think is true at all. You can really only know it on the basis of special revelation. You can't know the gospel without scripture. You just ultimately can't.
I mean, yeah, you can know that there is a God through creation. Like these are the classic apologetics arguments.
I mean, it's used in scripture too, but
yes,
again, Paul's appealing to natural revelation, but the idea of knowing the character of God in detail, the idea of knowing, you know, a Trinitarian nature of God in detail, yeah, that's not something you can get out of general revelation. The idea of the cross, you can't really get from general revelation.
Like, I mean, the assertion that the Greeks knew nothing about human nature, even if they were incomplete or imperfect, is not to suggest that they could not have possibly known anything. Like, I mean, even Paul actually refers to the Greeks want the Greeks are looking for wisdom and the Jews want a sign. So he's saying that Jews want miracles as kind of proofs and the Greeks want wisdom. So clearly, like the Greek wisdom was, you know, the church was able to appeal through Greek wisdom. And I will say, like, some, if you go up a little bit, like, I actually cite that Calvin uses a proverb of Cato as essentially to argue against excess luxuries. And then I kind of cite the source in Churton. But obviously, if you go to Cal Institute's book two, chapter two, there's a lot in there about how to approach the Greeks. And Churton does the same thing with heavy, extensive use of the Greeks throughout his institutes. And again, he uses the Greeks to prove the existence of God also in essence. Like, you can know that God is of one essence just using reason and logic. The Trinity, the full doctrine of Trinity, is something that can only be arrived at through revelation.
Right. So then we have this next dialogue that I assume is between Cohn and Eric Kahn and James White.
Yeah, this is the next question that comes up. So why do you assume that the ancient unity of tribe and family is inherently juxtapositional, or is inherently oppositional to fidelity in Christ? Why is it either or? So James White is about to say that it is either or, because every time scripture speaks of unity of the church, it does so outside the categories of tribe and family. You are, of course, well aware of this. He cites Colossians 3, which basically lists the Greek, Jew, circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and freeman, but Christ is all in all. And then certainly, this, I believe, is Eric Kahn, certainly would be a radical position for you to take compared to the great Christian fathers of church history and the Apostle Paul. And then James White asserts that he shared Paul's view of unity. It is that it is created by the Spirit, renewing the elect, not in tribes and family. And then he kind of appeals to authority, which, again, I mean, a lot of dispensationalists love asserting Romans 11, where, you know, Paul's pleading for the kinsmen of the flesh, you know, the Jews that he actually knew. And Paul also went to Jerusalem because of his love for his people, his specific, you know, his blood, people by blood. So, Paul's actions throughout scripture certainly showed that he longed for the salvation of his own people. So the idea that, you know, tribe and family did not, like, were opposed to the spiritual family, I don't necessarily see within the life of Paul. Like, he clearly valued both. It's not either or.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where there is still an order of affections, which is, you know, an Augustinian idea, but I'm pretty sure he didn't invent that. I believe he largely gets that from much of the Greeks. So why exactly is this being brought up in such a negative light?
So yeah, I bring up the fact that this is similar to the whole debate of, do you have more in common with your neighbor who's unsaved versus a Christian in a third world country who is saved? Because that's essentially the debate of what we're having. Who do you have more unity with?
In a cosmic way, you have more in unity with the Christian from around the world, but yes, that's like the only way.
That's the only thing you really have in common with them. So I actually say that, you know, that all, like, that members of all races are grafted into the true race of Israel, again, covenant theology for the win, is a glorious paradox, but it does not erase the existence of earthly categories, nor does it nullify the concept of ordo amores with regards that one should most love those within their immediate proximity.
Another add-on to that is every tribe, every tongue, every nation will bow and acknowledge God. That it does seem like they will be bowing and acknowledging God within their tribes, tongues, and nations. Like, they're going to be grouped while doing this.
And again, we see throughout the Old Testament, God valued the preservation of tribes Like, he didn't just say, okay, Israelites, you know, here's your promised land, go settle wherever you want. He actually intentionally went out of his way to preserve tribal unity. And again, I think there's multiple reasons why he did that. I talk about that in my Identitarian Politics article, but he did not have to do it that way. And I mean, and before someone Jesus jukes and says, well, the line of Christ was always recorded because David comes from the tribe of Judah. But the idea that the land had to be designated to a specific tribe was not something that had to be done. And all the measures in the Old Testament law that preserved that institution, that preserved the tribes, like that, God didn't have to ordain it that way, but he chose to. So there is clearly a principle that tribal, I guess, you know, the tribe is an important social construct.
All righty.
But one thing I point out is this is conflating two kingdoms theology, where we're assuming that the earthly kingdom has to be like the heavenly kingdom. And that's one of the flaws that James White is saying. Like, it's almost like he's assuming everyone in the nation is Christian. So therefore, you know, you have, or like, ethnic unity is possible because, you know, Christ came, rose from the dead, rules at the right hand of the Father. So therefore, you can have perfect philia in your society because of these things. But again, we see throughout history that's not always the case. We still live in a fallen world. So why are we assuming that human nature has inherently changed when it hasn't?
Yeah, I mean, for a second there, it looks like James White was going to argue in favor of multicultural societies, but it doesn't look like he goes in that direction, you would say.
Yeah, which is the entire argument of the quote.
And then, but he just ultimately wants to Jesus juke the conversation.
Pretty much, because again, it does have, you know, uncomfortable implications about race in America.
And not even with, you know, whites versus blacks in a way, because there was at least a period of time where, you know, the cultures were different, but at least they weren't, you know, at two separate, you know, nations in a way. But I do think things have definitely been hijacked. Liberation theology, I think, played a large role in that, and stuff like that.
No, part
and
of the
now it does, you know, it, whatever chasm existed beforehand, I think has widened in terms of two different people groups and two different nations, essentially. Well,
and that's why I talk about, you know, the 1965 Immigration Act. Like, is James White going to honestly argue that, you know, American society is not destabilized because of that law? I mean, he lives in Arizona? So he should know that Arizona is a vastly different place than it was, you know, 50 years ago.
People actually live there now.
Yeah. But I mean, the one thing I didn't talk about was social trust, that diversity erodes social trust. So that's all your social institutions, which would include churches, but also like civic clubs are have less value in a diverse society. So that's something that the book Bowling Alone talks about, which I don't actually reference in this article, but it basically talks about social trust is reduced by half because of diversity. And the 1950s is a period of high social trust in America, perhaps the highest ever. And since the
50s, certainly in the modern era.
Well, sure. I mean, with respects to polling, that's a period of very high social trust. And the only institution or group that has higher social trust now than the 1950s is veterans, which I guess comes from the fact that we are socially conscious of our veterans. But I mean, Christopher Caldwell and like Jeremy Carl have both published books in the last 5 years pertaining to the decline in essentially the racial strife that is, well, anti-white. So you have two books in the last 5 years that pretty much go to the paint about anti-white racism. And I kind of asked the question, are we not allowed to use this analysis because it's not scripture? Are we not allowed to use political analysis because it's not chapter and verse?
Right. Any last hot takes on this one before we switch to our other topic, which is Tim Walz?
Oh, as of right now, no. I mean, I guess go and check out the article because, I mean, there's more in it.
And there's definitely more articles at evangelicaldarkweb.org. Sign up for our newsletter. We've done some revamping on the newsletter. It's still linked in the description below. And drop that like and subscribe if you're new. So the newest, you know, the big news that came out lately was Tim Walz was selected to be Kamala Harris's running mate. And this is definitely a weird white guy. He has simp energy written all over him, but there's not a whole lot of, and honestly, I would have a hard time believing he's not a homosexual. I'm going to be honest.
It looks like he's chosen to be the most inoffensive guy option, like, out there. And obviously they chose him over Josh Shapiro. Because he would be less offensive to, I guess, their rabid Muslim base than a Shapiro would be.
Which I think is kind of ironic because I'm not sure how many of these people would refuse to vote for Kamala on those bases. It's not like she's not married to a Jew as it is. I mean, Kamala Harris, and I tweeted this out, she's Bolshevik in the sheets and in the streets. Therefore, you know, she can't really be anti-Semitic. That's like saying a white dude married to a black woman is, you know, hates black people. Like, I really don't think that that's a logical argument. So those are my thoughts. But in 2020, we were hearing about how interracial relationships, you're still racist. You know, if you're a white guy married to a black woman, which is the typical Hollywood relationship that, you know, that is the relationship that Hollywood is pushing. It's like the statistically the one that both groups like the least is the one that Hollywood pushes the most.
Yeah, because black women are least favorably disposed towards white men and white men towards black women.
But it's what Hollywood pushes the most, because if you're going to have a white star, you need to have a black woman love interest. So that's the logic behind it, in my opinion. The woke logic. But anyway, I digress. But in this case, we have a questionably black female with a white male star on the Democratic ticket. So Dusty Devers posted this thread. I wrote an article about how he is a ELCA Lutheran. So that's the gayest Lutheran denomination in the United States. It is definitely a top six gayest denomination in the United States. You'd be hard pressed to come up with five gayer denominations than the ELCA. And I'm talking about magnitude and direction here. Not just, you know, something that has no influence or anything like that. Like,
no, isn't Life Church ELCA too?
No, you're thinking ECC. They're Evangelical Covenant Church. Their history is rebelling against Lutheranism. But they are a very liberal denomination, and people take issue when I say that, but it's like this denomination codified side B theology. They codified critical race theory. They have women pastors. Like, how many more liberal, agenda items do you need before you just acknowledge that that denomination's gone? And they codified critical race theory in 2009, like they, you know, with Obama, which I believe is when wokeness took over the church, was during the Obama administration. We discovered it during the Trump administration. And then I believe we forced it into retreat.
Now the feminist question is the biggest issue encroaching.
Yeah, I do think that is true.
Not the gay, not the BLM.
I mean, I still think the gay is a huge issue. But again, Kamala Harris is a very good proxy for the feminist angle, though. So the media would have you believe that Walz is a folksy moderate, Dusty Devers says, but, you know, he's anything but. Harris picked VP and how he greenlit a law to take child custody from parents who oppose sex change surgeries. Now, this was the final straw. I don't know if you've heard that Andrew Isker announced that he is leaving the state of Minnesota.
Yes.
And this is why, this is the reason that he gave, was this law right here, that they can just take your kids. And people are like, oh, that's just in public schools. He's like, no.
No, because that would be through CPS.
Right. So, and then just a few months ago, Walz signed another bill mandating that Minnesota schools provide tampons in boys' bathrooms, which is why he's called Tampon Tim. So
I like how I actually saw a woman that would try to, you know, pass it off as like a good thing. Like, guys can be chivalrous by giving women tampons. And my response is just, yeah, the one guy in the universe that would actually attempt to do that would pick the wrong size.
I mean, it's just, what if she prefers pads over tampons? Then you just completely, you know, you done.
Like, you're better off trying to sell it for like men that have nosebleed problems. And
all right. So anyway, this is another clip from Walz where he's fanatically pro-abortion.
And my record is so pro-choice, Nancy Pelosi asked me if I should tone it down. I stand with Planned Parenthood, and we won! And my...
So, yeah, Nancy Pelosi said tone it down, and you heard his response. So, he let Minneapolis burn. I think we kind of all know how the mostly peaceful protest of 2020 went.
Also, I mean, you know, Derek Chauvin and all that happened in Minneapolis, or was it St. Paul? But yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, ground zero for the Summer of Love.
Yeah, it is. Happened under his watch. Kamala Harris raised money for the people to get bail. So got to remember that she's a contributor to this as well.
And that's a key issue that the Republicans should hammer that home on them, considering that BLM has lost favorability since 2020.
But they want to pander to black people and Jews.
But the whites are up.
And then we have, this is where he says one person's, this is just a quote that even the Republican Party is not dumb enough to screw up.
Don't ever shy away from our progressive values. One person's socialism is another person's neighborliness. Just do the damn work. Don't ever.
So that's Tim Walz praising, you know, socialism in a way. It doesn't get, I mean, is it going to get better from here? Who knows? He was also massive under Branch Davidianism, very much in favor of lockdowns and stuff like that. He was a Democrat governor. I believe maybe the governor of Colorado was probably the most merciful of the Democrat governors. But other than that, they were all pretty terrible. So you had a couple Republican governors that were on their level, but for the most part, the Democrat governors were just all bad, with just some varying degrees of worse. So they had a snitch hotline, which Larry Hogan did as well. He created a snitch hotline. I think they like, you know, kind of abandoned it because it got spammed. So this is where he promotes open
with folks. No,
this is where Tim Walz promotes invading our country.
And I think seeing a plan that's out there, talking about it with folks, knowing that he's not going to do anything. You know, he talks about this wall. I always say, let me know how high it is. If it's 25 feet, then I'll invest in the 30-foot ladder factory. That's not how you stop this. And I think,
again, that's him promoting, you know, essentially promoting, in my opinion, that's like treason to promote illegal immigration.
But it's not a problem because they're all Christians that are coming north of the border. And, you know, multi-ethnic societies can work out with shared faith.
He's also anti-free speech. And this is kind of like the big thing that might actually get him, you know, if they drop him from the ticket, which I don't think the chances are high, but it's not zero. It'll be over the idea that he has stolen valor, where he basically abandoned the people that he was, you know, he abandoned his deployment from or to Iraq, and then kind of claims to be a veteran after that. And like all the people from his group of, you know, a lot of them have come out trashing him over it.
I mean, that's actually good as far as like driving down his favorabilities, especially with, you know, middle America, like white America.
I just have a hard time believing the guy who was leading a gay straight alliance club at a high school was not having sex with boys. I have a hard time believing that.
Or his hard drives. Check those.
Yeah, you got to check those hard drives. Walls signed a bill to completely eliminate gas cars, stoves, and everything else by 2040. Of course, like all climate change bills, Dusty Devers says, it did not include nuclear energy within its definition of renewable energy. We wouldn't actually want to solve the problem, would we? Well, Gavin Ortland might approve of this. I just got to throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean,
he's an all of the above guy, and he believes that carbon dioxide is pollution. So what would be his objection to doing that?
I mean, again,
climate change is such a big deal.
And even the notion that fossil fuels are limited in supply is kind of not true. We can artificially create them if we needed to, but that's, you know,
it's just not cost effective.
Science lesson. But that's a science lesson for a different day.
I think that's also true about desalinization, but let's see. He participated in the scam that Joe Biden was fit for office. Well, that's like the least of his offenses. Well, and then
Kamala's going to bear the brunt for that, not Tim Walz. Like Kamala's going to have that on her record with Trump going, like Trump's going to hit her in the debates saying, you lied for Joe Biden. I should have been debating you last time. And just hit her with that.
I just don't think Kamala Harris will do well in a debate with Trump, but I don't think she can do as bad as Biden did, well, in my opinion. But,
yeah, you know, the floor is low.
And then Dusty Devers just has some posts from that are related to the ELCA, the gayest of Lutheran denominations in the United States. I'm not going to say the world, though, because I want to say the Church of Sweden is really, really gay. But so anyway, the main idea is that Walz is terrible in every way, shape, or form. Credit to Dusty Devers for putting that thread together. But anyway, you got any reaction while I get up the next?
I mean, he obviously is going to be. I guess I hear the talking point that he turned Minnesota into California. So that they're going to be able to hit him hard on that. I don't necessarily think he helps out. And again, I don't think the Kamala bump in the polls is actually real, because, I mean, if you're looking at RCP, Trump's still up in Pennsylvania. And a lot of the Bloomberg Morning Consult polls, which are kind of BS polls, are pushing Kamala ahead of Trump in the RCP average, which is just ridiculous. So I don't think he really benefits her in any way. And like those Midwest states are distinct. Like, you know, Wisconsin is not Minnesota, which is not Michigan. So there is some distinctions that will probably make a guy like J.D. Vance more appealing. Because, I mean, J.D. Vance can say, I went to Ohio State. And, yeah, all the Michigan fans will hate Ohio State. But, you know, he's speaking their language.
So there is one person who thinks that Tim Walz is a cool dude and, you know, has abhorrent policy positions, but, you know, J.D. Vance, you know, is all super fake, even though Tim Walz has basically lied about everything and, you know, service record and a lot of stuff. Like, there's not a whole lot of real there. And apparently he wasn't a head coach. Something like that. Like, you know, he's even stealing head coach valor, you know, in terms of being a football coach.
What's next? They won a state title and then they didn't.
He's
going to steal title valor too.
Unfortunately, the horse semen story is not true. It is a bit of a meme hoax that
I think it was revenge for what they did with JD Vance.
Yeah, they made up a story about JD Vance having sex with a couch.
Yeah.
So they came back and said that, and they probably did a better job at making it look real that Tim Walz, you know, had to have his stomach pumped from consuming a gallon of horse semen.
I mean, it's an actual thing that people gather. Like, that's how they, when they put horses out to stud.
Yeah, that does happen. But like, Tim Walz did FedEx not do
makes
that.
FedEx makes a lot of money doing that, shipping that stuff. So who is our guest? Our surprised video
so
guest.
Nick Fuentes wants to claim that Tim Walz is a real white guy. I just think this entire thing is pretty gay.
Yeah, Fuentes has been on fire lately, and not in a good way.
Yeah, because he's doing the whole brat thing, like, oh, Kamala Harris is such a brat, I love her type of thing. I don't get it. But and here's the thing. Here's where I think Nick Fuentes is getting, you know, because I'm pretty right-wing, and I guess he's sort of right-wing. When here's where we're really diverging. Nick Fuentes believes that Christians should ally with Muslims to oppose the Jewish order. I do not believe that we can ally with Muslims to oppose the Jewish order. You look at what's going on in Europe, it does not work. Christians and Muslims do not make good allies. Well, I mean, and that, I think, is the dividing... That's going to be the dividing line between the dissident right and the Nick Fuentes Groypers crowd.
Well,
that's the issue that needs to be debated. Can Muslims be allies in this coalition?
And I completely stupid idea, though. Because, like, the Zionists imported the Muslims, who then became rabid leftists, who just want to steal your stuff and, you know, violate...
They want to loot the treasury.
Yes. Like, again, even Bush, you know, Zionist president, who started two wars in the Middle East, like, that's when we started importing a lot of people from Muslim countries. That was under Bush.
What, more Muslim or more Iraqi Christians in Chicago than Iraq? I think J.D. Vance said that earlier this year.
Yeah, but all, like, we literally started two wars in the Middle East, had you know, during this global war on terror, while we're importing the people from those countries. So, yeah, it's a completely unproven concept. And of course, I've heard that, you know, Fuentes has taken, you know, Islamic money. And, you know, I mean, I've heard of Philo-Semitic. Is there Philo-Islamic? Is that, or can we brand Fuentes as Philo-Islamic?
I don't know, but I do think that that's what's going on here. So here's the clip.
You know, the Republicans picked this guy who's really just like a freak. They picked this guy who changed his name three times. They picked this guy who wrote a book that's dripping with contempt for his own people. He's a total weirdo. Like, this is not a real guy. What did he even do? Does anybody even know what he did? He wrote a book. He was a Marine, but he was a photographer. He went to Yale Law School. Did he ever practice? He started a company. What did that company actually make? You know, so who is this guy? And they said...
So he was one of the investors in PayPal, right? Or something like that?
Yeah, PayPal would have been before his time.
Okay.
I mean, obviously he's associated with Peter Thiel.
He's a tech investor, right?
Yeah, he was in the venture capital space. I don't quite know what he did from a background perspective other than like VC, and he was in that space. But I mean, obviously, like, a simple Wikipedia page or a Google search would have like answered a lot of these questions he's bringing up. And that's the weird thing.
We'll pick this fake weirdo. We'll pick this fake weirdo who ran from his roots, couldn't run away fast enough to leap into the arms of Silicon Valley and Yale Law School, and into the arms of an Indian wife who he cries about all the time.
She a crier.
And they said, we'll foist this guy on the Republicans. They'll love this. And then Kamala Harris, she actually picked a legit white guy. Everything that the GOP thought J.D. Vance was supposed to be, Tim Walz is, for better or for worse. He is actually like a normal guy. When he wears a T-shirt and a can-
Again, this is what I can't stand. It's like Tim Walz is a creep, and in no way do I believe that he doesn't. I just don't believe that someone who let a, you know, someone who's as pro gay as him was not also hidden the.
Yeah, I mean, and JD Vance,
I don't think he's not a homosexual.
Like JD Vance is appealing because he's kind of normal. I mean, yeah, I mean, the interracial.
Well, he's Appalachian stuff.
But I've also heard it described that, you know, no matter how rich and successful he got in like Silicon Valley world, at the end of the day, he was not one of them. He was always going to be the hick from Appalachia.
Yeah. I don't think him moving to Ohio was him fleeing from his roots. That's, and then I believe the subsequent leaping was, you know, the Yale Law School thing. But
anyway. Camo hat, it's not a costume, it's what he wears. And he doesn't have this weird obese face, grew a beard because he's so ugly. He doesn't wear eyeliner. He has a white wife, you know, normal. He has a normal wife. He doesn't have a wife with an unpronounceable name. And they didn't get married in some Hindu ceremony in Sri Lanka or whatever.
Sri Lanka is a Buddhist country, by the way.
He's got a normal wife and normal kids, and he looks normal. And he has normal clothes, and he's been a public servant. He was in the National Guard. He's been a public servant his whole life. He's like a left-wing populist. He's an advocate for teachers and things like that. And again, listen, I'm not glazing the guy. I don't support the guy's politics.
Is he glazing the guy? Not politically, but like phenotypically?
I mean, yeah. I mean, he's kind of like, wow. He's basically saying, I really like the packaging.
What he's not a good. Tim Walz is not a good-looking guy, and
I mean, if you know, said that about Gavin Newsom, no homo, I would at least understand.
Or like Andrew Cuomo.
If you look at Gavin Newsom's family, like how is that guy some rabid leftist governor? Like you would look at his family and say that's a Republican. You might even say he's one of those weird Christians that likes to pop out the kids. But no, we're not talking about Gavin Newsom.
Well. Are we talking about Gavin Newsom's family before he cheated on his wife with his campaign manager?
I'm thinking of like the family that like they show the picture of with like all the children and stuff. It's like, wow, it looks like a normal American family.
Right. I mean, I don't know if even JD Vance, definitely not normal packaging. Nothing about him is really normal, but I don't think he's not the weirdo that they're trying to brand him as, especially when Tim Walz believes in putting, you know, tampons in women's bathrooms and taking your kids away. Or, sorry, men's boys' bathrooms. Yeah.
Okay, the guy supports abortion. The guy supports transgenderism. That stuff is absolutely evil and inimical to everything I believe in, and I would never vote for him. I would never vote for anyone like that. But although he has views I disagree with and views that are radical in a social context, he's like a normal guy. He's like living a normal life. He is who he says he is. Yeah, we may hate what he represents, which is this like folksy, hippie, left-wing populism. But he is like a normal American from Minnesota. He is like a normal Minnesotan. Whatever you think about it, he's an American. Vance is like a total freak.
So, yeah, I'm not sure I can really get down with that. So, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just because he's white doesn't mean he's a normal American. And keep in mind, Minnesota hasn't voted Republican since, what, Nixon? So they voted Walter Mondale, so it's not like they're a normal white state, white majority state. Obviously, he changed their flag to look like Somalia. So he's not exactly a normal white guy.
It doesn't look quite like Somalia, but it does look like, other than this, they changed the number of points on the stars, but you know, it definitely looks like it could be one of the provincial flags of a Somalian. You know, it looks like it would fit in with all the Somalian flags. So. Anyway, those are just my thoughts. Like, I think that clip was kind of gay.
Yeah, I mean, and those rumors have been circulating around Fuentes for years. I can say on, let's just say, credible secondhand account that, you know, there's credible evidence that he is a homosexual.
Well, yeah, there's the public evidence, which involves
There's the public evidence, but there, I can say on credible secondhand account, not firsthand, that, yeah, there's reasonable suspicions. Like from someone that has been in the same
room. Witnesses.
Yes, from eyewitnesses. Yeah. And again, he's very Islamophilic, where he is siding with Muslims for perhaps financial reasons, and perhaps because his audience is kind of leaning that way. So that's.
There are a number of right-wing influencers who are Islamic.
Yeah, and I mean, you're seeing some of that.
Andrew Tate might be the most recognizable, but there's a few others.
Myron Gaines would be another one. And a lot of them advocate like the most hedonistic lifestyles ever. And let's just be honest, Andrew Tate's a Muslim because it justifies his lifestyle, not because he actually cares what the tenets of their faith are. Which is actually very common with certain Islamic converts in the West, is they just like the sexual aspect of Islam.
Yeah, it makes sense. So anyway, those are my thoughts on the whole Tim Walz thing. I don't know if you have that. Not much else to contribute. Let's do a last call for questions. Again, I don't need to stay on the stream too much longer. Muslim beat Blake Masters. Oh, yeah. Blake Masters lost his primary, or is that referring to something else?
Is that referring to Abe or whatever her name was? Which is a shame, considering like Blake Masters is like an awesome guy. Also, very much like if you like Blake Masters, you should like JD Vance. They're cut from the same cloth, and obviously they have that Peter Thiel connection, which also is. Aligns with Vivek Ramaswamy. So, you know, three peas in a pod kind of thing. But I mean, Kerry Lake's the real problem in Arizona, not.
Yeah, that's true.
Not the Muslim.
So this channel seems bent on giving a voice to this Nazi nut job, referring to Nick Fuentes. Did we give him a favorable voice or just acknowledge that he has an opinion on Tim Walz that a lot of people on the right seem to be sharing, and therefore because of the nature of who he is and the comments that he made on the subject that we're talking about, it was relevant.
I mean, I literally said he's Islamophilic. That's pretty favorable in the same way that, you know, Doug Wilson and some people might be, philo-Semitic. So.
Would you publish political cartoons? Yes, I would. I do have articles publishing memes, so I wouldn't mind doing cartoons. I guess the question is, I don't have the talent for that, and I don't want to like steal other people's content to do that without their permission. Just my opinion on that. But, you know, if someone wanted to draw cartoons for me to publish, I would be open for that. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, don't go to me for art.
Yeah, I cannot draw with my hands, and I'm not overly good with graphic design. I've gotten better at photoshopping and creating thumbnails and stuff like that for videos, but I'm not artistic with my hands, or, you know, maybe with my mind it can be, but not with art or paintings and graphics and stuff. So, you know, if you want to see my artistic prowess, I did make the logo for Evangelical Dark Web. I did do that. So that's all I got. So what things we got coming up on Evangelical Dark Web? I know I've been working on, I'm 90%, maybe 95% done the Megan Basham book. So I'll have a review on that soon. I'm trying to schedule a time to talk about, to land that interview. Looks like it might be a pre-record, so I can drop that at my discretion when we record it. But those are some things to look forward to. Keith Foskey is going to be our guest next week. So that's going to be exciting. We're going to be talking about Baptistic Calvinism and amillennialism, two things that he is a staunch defender of. So that sounds exciting. I'm going to try booking more guests, but you know, once I figure out the Megan Basham thing, yeah, I'm at the part where she hits Keller hard. She hits Keller hard in the part that I'm reading. I'm like, whoa, that's what I'm talking about. Cause she, this, where I'm impressed is that she knew more about Keller's involvement with this than I did. I focused more on other people. So you and Keith Foskey followed me on Twitter the same day. I'm like, yeah. You know, you got to follow some of your best supporters. You just got to. I don't like waging war on, you know, my audience like some other people out there. But which is totally just a reference to some people in the political commentary arena. They just kind of war with their own audience. But I don't like to do that. I say what I have to say, and, you know, I'll interact with the chat sometimes. The Gavin Ortland people, I'll troll them and respond. I just, you know, that's
like, it's almost like these attacks against Megan Basham are so coordinated. Like today was all about the abuse and how she named Alyssa Womack as the
yeah, woman. Yeah, I read that last night. I'm like,
that did the foreplay with Johnny Hunt.
Yeah, she doesn't get into all the details of what happened, but she does name the person and throws the lawyer under the bus for not redacting it. But it's like, you know what? There's nothing wrong with naming it. There's a journalistic reason to name it, unlike that one reporter who's like, we gave her such assurance that she would not be named. It's like, well, you're not a real journalist. That's why you work for the Texas Tribune. But anyway, they're trying to cancel her. I think this is a pretty important fight because this book gives us the opportunity to broadcast things that we've been reporting for years to a much larger audience and with the wind at our backs. So I think these are high times to be a discernment ministry, you know, in my opinion. So,
yeah, and again,
exciting times.
If you survive this cancellation attempt, that's a victory. Exactly. I mean, you essentially survived a bunch of zombies coming at you and you held your ground.
Yeah. So anyway, don't forget to smash that like button and subscribe if you are new. And you can support our work over at evangelicaldarkweb.org/join. That gives you bonus access to bonus content. I'll get some bonus content hopefully this weekend. Some extra hot takes. We've had a lot of, you know, deeper dives into things like the whole Gavin Ortland story. I did a whole report on Emmanuel Church, which might be the worst church in the United States because it has Russell Moore, Gavin Ortland, Ray Ortland, and Sam Alberry all in one church. And then on top of that, Barnabas Piper, which I'm not trying to, who seems famous for two reasons. One, he's John Piper's son, and secondly, a highly publicized divorce, which is very unfortunate. But I didn't lump him in with the other four, but he is a footnote because it's like there's a lot of celebrity influence just in this one church. And that's very odd. I don't know if there's another church.
Nashville is such a nice city, too. It's like you have all these just wicked people.
Like there's churches that breed people, like Capitol Hill Baptist Church, Mark Devers Church, they breed people to be Big Eva influencers, or even MacArthur's. Grace Community Church, they breed people to be bigger in the Reformed world, but they don't, you know, no one, they're not like a, you know, a honeysuckle attracting false teachers from all over the world to be there. And by all over the world, you know, Sam Alberry is British. So, Yuwani's Piper's son, too. He's Piper's son. He's like, and he's the one that's not an atheist. So anyway, those are my thoughts on that. Exciting time to be alive, in my opinion. But that's all we got for today. My name is Ray. This is the Evangelical Dark Web. Stay based. Christ is King. And we.